Rear Admiral Desmond W. Pierce, Royal Canadian Navy, retired in Halifax on the 7th of January, 1982. Thank you for coming down, Debbie. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Hal. I'm very delighted to have this opportunity to put a few thoughts on tape. As you know only too well, talking to old salts, this is a thing we all intend to do, but very seldom ever get around to doing it. And I congratulate you most sincerely on your 10-year effort to achieve this, and I thank you for asking me here today. Hal, as you know, I started off in the Navy through the entry system of the Royal Military College, and I think for a moment I'll go back to that stage and say why I went to RMC and why I joined the Navy. Well, this takes me back to the summer of 1930. At that time, the economic conditions were not getting all that good in Canada and the rest of the world, but life was still pretty good in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I had got through high school at a fairly youngish age, finished senior matric at the age of 16, and normally I would have gone to Dalhousie University, where my mother, 50 or so years before, had graduated as a doctor in medicine, and she was rather keen that perhaps I should follow that, or perhaps be a lawyer. Well, I had a, being young and rather smugly a nice little boy, I rather decided I didn't want to get into the atmosphere of sophomores and freshmen at Dalhousie, all who were drinking and doing terrible things like that, that I would like, in fact, to meet some kids from the rest of Canada. And somebody mentioned to me about Royal Military College, that was a place where you kids came from all over Canada and you meet quite a broad section. Well, rather liked that idea, sought some advice and discussed it with my father and mother, and made an application to go to RMC. As the allocations to RMC were done on a provincial basis, there were something like six allowed for Nova Scotia, and no more than one or two normally would ever apply. I was accepted for RMC, and within a matter of a few weeks I was off to Kingston, Ontario, to join that great institution. Well, I won't go at any length on what happened at RMC other than to say it was a most magnificent establishment with tremendous education and training. You met a bunch of guys, you went through the ringer together, you were hardened and toughened and with real experience of physical endeavor and an academic program of staggering proportions by present-day standards. And you worked at this in your 10 months that you were at RMC. You were constantly, absolutely banging the books and bashing the parade ground. In the 2 years I was at RMC, just to perhaps put it into perspective that young people might understand these days, I was a guy who I've always enjoyed the fair sex. Never once did I have a date in the 2 years that I was at Royal Military College. There just wasn't any time for such thing. You were too damn busy with your studies and all the program that RMC had to offer. Well, during the summertime, RMC offered for the so-called gentleman cadets training with either the Army or the Air Force. And the year I went there, they started training with the Navy. This was purely a voluntary idea. If you wanted to spend 2 months with one of those services and get paid for your work. Well, as I lived in Halifax, and the Naval course was in Halifax, and I had a pretty little gal down here I wanted to make some money to take to the movies, I applied for the Naval course in Halifax, and I was accepted for that. In the summer of 1931, I came down to Halifax with a group of about 15 or 20 RMC cadets. And we did instruction ashore, and then we took some cruises. I can remember only too well, in my group, our instructor was Lieutenant H.F. Pullen. And a name not to be taken lightly in the Royal Canadian Navy. Well, I'll say right off the bat that in those 8 weeks that we had with Lieutenant Pullen in summer of 1931, I learned all the seamanship that I needed to know after I actually joined the Navy and spent a year as a cadet. In that year, there was nothing new I was taught that Lieutenant Pullen had not taught us RNC cadets in six or 8 weeks of summer training before that. And he was incredibly keen, and we learned a great deal, and we had a great deal of fun. Well, I went back to RNC for the second year, still thinking perhaps I might do 4 years at RNC, then come back to Halifax and go either to the medical school or the law school at Dalhousie. And I did fairly well academically, but by the summer of 1932, after 2 years at RNC, the depression had bitten quite deeply, and all families in Canada were suffering economic hardships. And my own family asked me a straight question. Are you going to really work at RNC and maybe improve your academic standard, or are you going to work, period? And having done this second summer of naval training and gone on cruises with the Canadian Navy up to the Bridor Lakes and Magdalen Islands and places like that, I told my family, well, if you'd really like to know what I want to do, I'd like to join the Navy. And this absolutely staggered my father and my mother. My mother soon smiled. I think she could see her boy in shining gold and navy blue uniform. And she was easy. My father was a little more difficult to convince. And I took him up to the dockyard to meet our senior officers, who at the time was Commander Nellis and Commander Murray. And they both convinced my father that the naval career for a young chap from RNC might be a very good idea. And as I was keen for it, my father agreed. Well, this was getting on the latter half of August, and if I were going to join the Navy, I had to make up my mind quickly, because one had to get over to, as we had no training facilities for officers in 1932, I had to get over to the UK very quickly. In fact, within about 2 weeks. So when it was agreed, practically at that first interview with my father and these two senior officers, my application to join the Navy went in by a naval message to Ottawa, and I suppose a telephone call or two as well. I think they were rather keen in Ottawa to use me as a guinea pig to find out, would RNC be a good entry into the Navy? And since I was the youngest of the cadets who came down for that summer training, I was still young enough to catch up to the normal training that was in existence at that time for young officers. So my family having agreed, myself being desirous of doing this, within 7 days of having made that decision, I left Halifax, Nova Scotia, to go to Montreal to catch a Cunard A-boat to go to Britain, and I was gone for 5 solid years.
I have a question. Were you then the first RMC cadet in the Royal Canadian Navy?
Yes, I was. There was one other officer a few years older than I, Bill Plouston, who left Royal Military College and joined the Royal Navy, but I was the very first to go from Royal Military College into the Royal Canadian Navy.
So, one other question. Your trips to the Bridor Lakes, in what ships?
That was in the Saguenay, which at that time was a brand new ship. I think she came out, built in the UK, came out in 1931, the first summer I went for cruises in the Patriot, or the Patrician, I think it was the Patriot, with Bully Pressey as captain. And the second summer, in summer of 1932, I went to sea in the Saguenay with perhaps 5 or 6 other RNC cadets. And our captain was Commander Len Murray, and our navigator was Lieutenant Commander Harold Grant. Our torpedo officer was Lieutenant Commander Roger Bidwell, all names you will recognize of those who later became admirals in our service. So I had some very good training that summer.
When I was a snotty RCNVR, Pressey was called Hard of Starboard Pressey. Well, because of his trouble with his neck.
Well, he had some probably a slight bit of arthritis or something that caused his head to lean very distinctly to starboard. As you say, he was always known as starboard list. He was very good fun as a skipper.
He was known as that back then, starboard
list. Oh, yes,
list
back in 1932, 1931, he was known as starboard list.
Thank you. Can you tell me something about Admiral, I keep calling him Admiral Murray?
Well, Admiral Murray was our skipper aboard the Saguenay. He was a gentleman of enormous, to whom one could give enormous admiration. He had a placid character. He had a very distinguished bearing, of course. He had a great interest in those on board, and he was greatly loved. This followed Admiral Murray all through his career, as you know only too well. And of course, the tragedy that came in his moment of victory is one that stunned and disappointed us all beyond belief.
Yes. The lower deck at that time, this is the 1930s, the standard of sailor in the lower deck at that time is their professional training and their general attitude towards the Navy is always of interest to historians. What about that?
Well, I didn't see that all that much. Well, we lived on board. We were rather peculiar birds, the RMC cadets. We wore our RMC uniforms, and we were pretty smart, if I may say so, and I use that in a good sense. We were very super smart in our physical movements, our dress, and we had some wonderful training at RMC, and when we got aboard the ships, we rather felt that it was incumbent on us to uphold this tradition of RMC cadets. Well, aboard the Saguenay, one of the ratings that we remember with enormous affection was a person who has become a great personality and a senior officer in the Royal Canadian Navy. That chap, when he was a leading torpedoman aboard the Saguenay, was not going to have any damn nonsense to let any of these RMC cadets be smarter than anybody aboard the Saguenay, and he was the smartest thing on 2 feet you ever saw. And if we came to attention with a smart click of the heels, this leading hand, he was ahead of us by streets, and he was absolutely the smartest thing you ever saw in his life. And you can probably guess who that was. That was Pat Fudge. Admiral Pat Fudge. And Budgie was a tremendous personality in those days. And, of course, he deservedly climbed the ladder. Nothing could stop him. He had that wonderful ability to just drive forward with good humor and an intensity of effort that even put us RMC cadets to shame.
Yeah.
The other members of the ship's company, we didn't see all that much of. Not being sort of in the service and only being there for a few weeks, everybody was our friend. I guess we knew who was an officer and who wasn't, but the ships of the RC, and of course there were only a handful, a couple in Halifax and a couple out on the West Coast and some minesweepers, and our Navy was rather pitifully small, but it was growing. New ships were being built. The Saguenay had been built and the Skeena had been built, and we had the old Patriot and Patrician, and there were promise of other things to come.
So there you are. That's the end of your first summer in the Navy.
Second summer.
Second summer in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
In your
not yet in the Navy. Second summer of naval training.
Naval training.
The first summer,
yes.
I was acting probationary midshipman, Royal Canadian Volunteer Reserve. And the second summer, I was a cadet the first summer and a probationary midshipman acting voluntary.
Yeah, temporary.
temporary in 1933.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
1932.
Yeah, and then you had to make up your mind to go to the UK.
So then I made the decision to join the Royal Canadian Navy. Now, what that entailed was, since the Navy was so small at that time, we had no officer training facilities of our own. The training of Royal Canadian Naval cadets was carried out in the UK with the Royal Navy. And the system at that time was a 5-year course, or progressive series of training events. The first year one did as a cadet, and you joined, there were two systems of entry into the Royal Navy. One system was the direct entry, which a young UK chap would go to Dartmouth Naval College at the age of about 13, 13 and a half, or 14. He would go there for 4 years, and then he would become a midshipman, and so on along the line of promotion. The other entry into the Royal Navy was what they called special entry, and that allowed for an intake of young officers into the Royal Navy who had attended public schools in the UK, public schools being private schools, of course. And the boys from Eton and Rugby and Harrow and the other great schools of England, when they had finished what was equivalent to our Canadian high school, they would apply to join the Navy, and they would join as a group of special entry cadets. And that is the group where the Canadians went from their high schools, or in my case, from Royal Military College, if one were young enough, you'd join up with the British boys of the special entry system. And that was 1 year as a cadet. You then became a midshipman and lived aboard ship as a midshipman for a period of 2.5 years. So there we are, 3.5 year period. At the end of that time, you had a very stringent examination in seamanship to become qualified as a lieutenant, although you were still only a midshipman. After your 2.5 years at sea as a midshipman, you then went to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich to get back to do academics again, get back to history and mathematics and physics and chemistry and languages. That lasted for about 7 or 8 months. And then, sort of having had a university refresher course, we then went down to Portsmouth in southern England, where we did the technical courses. We did navigation and communications and gunnery and torpedo, that type of thing. And at the end of all of that time, you were examined in each of those subjects, and you got so many points of first, a second, or a third class. And then, according to how well you did in your exams for seamanship plus those technical courses, you then got your promotion from acting sub-lieutenant to sub-lieutenant, and your seniority was adjusted according to the number of first classes, second and third that you've got. In my own case, I went over with two other Canadians. Murray Davidson, who my great colleague for so many years, as a paymaster cadet, and then there was Ted Clark, who became an engineer officer. They were both from, Murray Davidson came from Vegreville out west, I remember. Ted Clark, I'm not just positively sure, certainly was not Nova Scotia, and I met these chaps aboard the ship going across in early September 1932. And the three of us, I was an executive, not a paymaster or engineer, and the three of us, we went to Plymouth. And there we started our 5 years of training with the Royal Navy.
What ship did you go to when you left Dartmouth? A battleship?
I left RMC.
No.
Oh. Well, we didn't go to Dartmouth. See, our system was the special entry. We went straight aboard a ship.
Oh, I see.
A training ship. To do that year. We did our year as cadets.
What ship then?
Initially we went to Plymouth. And we went aboard a British Monitor. A Monitor was a very shallow draft bombarding ship with an enormous single or perhaps a twin mount of 15-inch guns. Very broad, very flat bottom. It was designed by the Royal Navy so it could move around the English Channel in shallow waters and carry out bombardments. And as such, was a unique vessel. There were only two of them built. And the Erebus was at anchor in Devonport Harbor. And my two colleagues and myself, an early September afternoon, we went aboard and we started this year's training. Already there was a senior class of Royal Navy cadets there, special entry, about 70 of them, and we were about 80 young British boys doing. We Canadians joined the first class of.
So then
the
after,
British Special Entry Cadets.
Then after Erebus, then?
Well, I'd like to say one or two things about Erebus.
Oh,
Erebus had a full complement of Royal Naval officers, and I can remember very well the day I joined the Erebus. As a matter of fact, I remember so well that the day I arrived in Plymouth with Murray Davidson and Ted Clark, we arrived about 5:30 in the morning, and a tender, an old paddle wheel tug came out and got us off this Kinnardy Sonia, I think it was, and took us ashore at about, before 6 o'clock in the morning. And here we were landed in a strange country, never having been there before. We knew people spoke English, and that's about all. And we were landed just under the famous Plymouth Hoe, where Drake had bowled his, finished his game of bowls before he took on the Spanish Armada. And we were too early for anything to happen in Plymouth, and we went for a walk out the end of a long pier. At the end of that walk, there was a workman out there, just sort of having a cigarette before he was going to whatever his job might be. And we struck up a conversation with this chap, and he was a West countryman, lived somewhere down around, lived, of course, in Devon. And he said, "Well, lad, it's lovely to see you over there in England." And he asked us where we came from. He said, "We came from Canada." "Ooh, Canada, do you?" He said, I've got a daughter out in Canada. I wonder if you'd know her. I said, "Well, very unlikely." And this chap said, "Well, she happens to be in Halifax, Nova Scotia." And I said, "Well, we've just come from Halifax, Nova Scotia." "Oh, my goodness, then you may know her. She's married to a lad in the Navy." And we said, "Well, we're coming over here to join the Navy." "Oh," he says, "well, I wonder if you'd know a chap. He was an engineer or artificer or something like that aboard a ship called the Saguenay." And I said, "Well, look, this is just too ridiculous. I've just spent the summer aboard the Saguenay, and the engine room artificer was one of the fellows I worked with the navigator, Lieutenant Commander Grant." He says, "Well, this is just too much of a coincidence. Now, let's see if we can't put the pieces together. The lad that I'm speaking of, his name is E.A. Bridgehouse. Do you know E.A. Bridgehouse?" I said, "Well, look, this just beats everything. The first man I speak to in the U.K. is the father-in-law of E.A. Bridgehouse, who was aboard the Saguenay with me, and every time the Saguenay went to sea that summer of 1932, I was the assistant to the navigator, and I would get E.A. Bridgehouse, and I'd say, 'Bridgie, have you got the compass lined up?' And Bridgie would say, 'I have, sir.' He said, 'She's lined up 30, we used to be a jetty number 4 in the dockyard, she's lined up with a jetty 304 degrees. I said, 'Bridgie, that's right, I'll report to the navigator.'"
Oh, God.
Ah, well, there are lots of stories like that. I then, we watched the unfolding of a day in the UK. I remember that September day, I think it was about the 2nd of September. And we went up on Plymouth Hoe at about 6:30 or 7:30. And at 7 o'clock, a whole lot of people began whizzing by on bicycles, and hundreds of them. And they were all driving bicycles, pedaling bicycles, and they were all dressed the same way. And we thought, what kind of a political movement is this? They were all dressed in gray flannel trousers and sort of a brownish tweed jacket. And they were pumping their bicycles, obviously on their way to the dockyard. And we asked somebody, he said, "What's all this going on? Who are these people all dressed the same way?" They said, "Oh, that's nothing special. These are all lads from Devon going to the dockyard. Everybody dresses that way." This was our first introduction to the people of the UK. Well, that day we went to Mr. Gieves, where our measurements had been sent by telegram, and we fitted our uniforms. And at 4 o'clock we were due aboard the Erebus in Devonport Dockyard. And I was the only one who had the naval training. My two colleagues, Davidson and Clark, had just come from high school, but I knew all about the Navy, and when 4 o'clock meant exactly 4 o'clock. And we found out where the ship was early in the day in the dockyard, and we could see the Erebus. And at about 4:01, we were just 30 seconds away from the gangway, not wanting to be early, not wanting to be late. And I was saying to myself, "Boy, you spent 2 years at RMC. It was tough. Brother, it was tough. But wait till you get to the Royal Navy, boy. Shiver me timbers, lad. Stand by, stand by. You're really going to get it now." And I was pretty toughened friendly abuse and instructions of a rather violent kind from Royal Military College. But I was all prepared for something rather special from the great Royal Navy. So exactly at 4 o'clock, as the ship's bell rang out, "Gidoing, gidoing, gidoing, gidoing," 8 bells, Cadet Piers put his foot on the gangway and marched aboard the Erebus, and with a very experienced naval salute, greeted the officer of the watch, "Officer Cadet Piers reporting on board for duty, sir." And this dear old gentleman who was what was called a commissioned officer. He was commissioned from the lower deck, and he had one stripe, which is the acme of his career. He was of officer status, and there he was, officer on the quarter deck of the Erebus. And as I saluted, waiting for the bolts of thunder to come around my head, he looked at me and said, "Hello, laddie, who are you?" And I repeated this again. He said, "Where have you come from?" And I said, "From Canada." And my two colleagues here. He said, "Oh, laddies, it's lovely to see you. You're just in time for a nice cup of tea. Come on down to the wardroom." Well, it was quite a change. We had 3 months aboard the Erebus in Portsmouth, and we learned seamanship, navigation. As I say, seamanship was a piece of cake. I'd been taught it all by Lieutenant Pullen. Navigation, of course, we had to learn a lot more. And generally, those were our two main topics. We used to do a lot of PT, and there again, there's an interesting comparison, Royal Navy habits. When we went to the gymnasium, there I was on pretty strong ground. After 2 years at RNC, I could do all sorts of gymnastics, and I was physically tough, and I could do all the fancy twists and turns and handstands and upstarts and things in the gymnasium, and I just loved the gym. And we'd had a lot of it, of course, at RNC. And when we got in the gym, there were two instructors. There was a leading seaman in the Royal Navy, and there was a sergeant of Royal Marines. And we went into the gymnasium the first time. This is a group of about 70 Brits. By this time, I was beginning to get used to the British boys. They looked the same as we did. They talked a lot differently. But let me tell you, you know the one who talked differently aboard that ship. It was the three Canadians. We were lined up for the PT, and very soon the leading seaman came out, leading seaman Hawkins. He said, "Hello, me lads." He said, "I'm leading seaman Hawkins of the Royal Navy." And I said, "I'm glad to have you lads all here. Now, we'll just try a few things. Come along, me lads. We do a little side jump. One, two, one, two, one, two. Very nicely. Thank you. Alt." And we do something else very gingerly, very, very lazily, very gently. And I said to myself, "Brother, is this the Royal Navy I heard about?" And I could see the sergeant of Royal Marines standing like a ramrod alongside the wall bars that were outside of the gymnasium that we had aboard this ship. And he was just there, never moving his head, but his eyes looking at us all right with a rather disgusted look. And then after leading seaman Hawkins had given us about 10 minutes of this easy, easy stuff, he said, "I'd now like to introduce you to my friend and colleague, Sergeant Maker Royal Marines. Sergeant Maker, will you take over?" Well, this Royal Marine stepped out, and he was a magnificent-looking man. He stood there with a figure that you'd just admire anywhere in a beautifully clean uniform. He says, "Class, top of the wall bars." I knew he was my man. We Canadians did very well in that line. But the Erebus was a fine experience. And at the end of those 3 months, we were then going to go to still cadets. The 70 of us who were Brits and Canadians were going to go to a new form of training for cadets, and that was a seagoing training ship, HMS Frobisher. So just before Christmas, we left the Erebus. I'm happy to say that when it came to dishing out responsibility for the next cruise, that Cadet Piers was made the chief cadet captain of all the 70 British cadets. And as we went aboard a few weeks later after Christmas leave aboard the Frobisher, the seagoing training ship, I was the boy in charge of our group of special entry cadets. And this was something that Canadians had achieved on many occasions before. I know Admiral Pullen was chief cadet captain, and I know that Commodore Midland was also chief cadet captain. So we have a little history there to keep up with.
That's good, yeah. So, Erebus.
Well, then we went from Erebus to the Frobisher. Frobisher was the same type of training for the cadets, except it was in a seagoing cruiser. And the Frobisher was one of a special class of large end of First War cruisers. One of them, the Raleigh, was lost up on the coast of Labrador, and her hull is still there, by the way. If anybody comes down that way, she got lost in the fog and grounded there and never got off. But the Frobisher had been specially fitted out with things like laundries and additional accommodation and bathrooms. And in the Frobisher, we joined the boys from Dartmouth. And this was quite an event. The boys who joined us from Dartmouth, had already been for over 3 years at Dartmouth together. They knew each other. They had their own little special friendships, their cozy little chumminess, and they looked upon the special entry boys as rather odd. And in my outlook on as a raw young Canadian on British boys, I got very used to the special entry cadets who'd been to the public schools. Somehow they seemed to me a much more well-balanced, rounded boys. The boys from Dartmouth were very ingrown in their outlooks and their personalities. We sort of eyed each other with suspicion and indifference. The public school boys, the pubs, the special entry, were inclined to look down on the Dartmouth. And there's no doubt that Dartmouth looked down on the pubs, but it didn't take long to straighten that away. Before the cruise was over, the next 3 months, we had all become a fairly well-welded group. So there we were, once again, three Canadians with about 150 or maybe 200 cadets aboard the Frobisher. We had a wonderful cruise. We left Chatham and went down to Gibraltar, and then we crossed via the Azores over to Barbados, and we went all around the West Indies for about 3 months as cadets. And everywhere we went, of course, the cadets were away. And when in harbor, we'd go away in the boat sailing and carrying out seamanship maneuvers and learning our trade, and at the same time seeing these lovely tropical islands and going to play tennis on the governor's tennis court.
Did you work part ship? Did you take the place of some of the seamen?
I'm glad you asked that, Hal. In the Frobisher, the system was a little different from the Erebus, because we did. We were all allocated to a different part of the ship, and we worked with the sailors on the lower deck. And there the idea there was to get to know the sailors and what kind of a working routine they had. And that routine is pretty rough. Reveille was 5:30 every morning. 6 o'clock was hands fall in. You might get a cup of cocoa before if you got out of your hammock in time. Incidentally, we slept in a hammock every night, and you had to lash up your hammock and stow it away. Very comfortable, a hammock, incidentally. And we started work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and from 6 to about 6:45, or nearer 7 o'clock, 5 to 7, we did what was called clean ship, just exactly what it says. We scrubbed the decks, and we cleaned out the heads, the toilets, and we did all those tasks and polished the brass and got the ship ready for the day. At 7:05, we were pipe hands to breakfast. And we hands to breakfast and clean. That was
yes.
The pipe. So we went and had a shower and a shave and put on our uniform for the day and went to the mess and had breakfast, and then we were free till about 7:55, and then you'd all fall in for colors in the morning. This is when you're in port.
What was the food like?
Food was, I never had any complaint. Food aboard naval ships almost uniformly was excellent. Mm-hmm. It was as good as the officers and the other men wished to make it. And I cannot ever remember, really, having bad meals in any ship. Certainly not in any ship where I had anything to do with it,
no.
Whether they were good or not. But even in those early days, I had never thought of it until you asked the question then. The food was very good, and lots of it, too. Well, the Erebus did that cruise to the West Indies and came back to Chatham in June. We had 3 or 4 weeks leave. Now, I didn't know anybody over in the UK then. I knew one person, really, Midshipman Peter Gretton, who had come here in a Royal Navy cruiser that summer of 1932. I brought him and a friend of his down to Chester with my family. We had a wonderful weekend there, sailing, regatta week, and he made a great hit with all the summer visitors. And when I went over to England, he was the only real person, only personal acquaintance I had in the whole of Britain. And I went to stay with him and his family on many, many occasions over a great number of years. You obviously know that Peter Gretton later became Vice Admiral Sir Peter Gretton, one of the greatest anti-U-boat men on the Battle of the Atlantic, and a prolific author and still going strong, and he was here visiting us at my behest last May, and he gave us all a lecture here in Halifax. Well, we had a few weeks leave, and in the UK, and I was taken under the wing of what's called the Victoria League, rather like the Royal Commonwealth Society, and I went and visited several families in different parts of England who were always welcoming young gentlemen from the so-called colonies to come and have a holiday with them, and it was very nice indeed. Well, the second cruise was a northern Baltic cruise in late June, July, and August, and that was a wonderful trip. The old Erebus again. By this time, I was no longer chief cadet captain because with the Dartmouth boys, they had a system where you changed your cadet captains every week. And, of course, this just led to chaos because you're in charge one week and you're not in charge the next week, and I'll get you for what you did to me. It wasn't all that successful, but I was just glad to sit back and let things happen rather than be the one in charge, and thoroughly enjoyed it, being a slacker for a bit. Well, the second cruise was a dandy. We first of all went up to Scapa Flow, the famous Scapa Flow. There we saw German battleships that came there to surrender at the end of the war. Remember, they pulled the plug and sank themselves. And one of them had turned turtle and was bottom up, a Derflinger, a name like that. And there she was. You could go along in Scapa Flow and see the its enormous underside of a German battleship showing above the water. And one soon learned all the details of that. And when you think of it, I'm talking now 1933, and the war ended in 1918, not all that number of years after the First World War. Well, from Scapa Flow, we went on to the coast of Norway. We went to Hardanger Fjord, which is the deepest fjord, I think, in Norway. An unbelievable depth of narrow fjord, deep, deep water, gorgeous scenery, and the midnight sun. The darkness just did not exist at that time of the year. From there, we went into the Baltic. We went to Helsinki, the capital of Finland. Naturally, I had never been in these places before. We're in Helsinki. I can remember it very well. It was on the 1st of July, which was Canada Day, and I made some phony excuses and got a little extra leave with Davidson and Clark, and we hit the town, and although nobody could speak much English in those days, we found Helsinki a historic place and very interesting. We then sailed to a place still in Finland called Björksund, in the city there, the ancient city of Viborg, V-I-B-O-U-R-G. Well, Viborg was a really ancient Baltic city, and very old and wonderful to see. Not much to do, but wonderful to see. We just spent a couple of days there. And that part is interesting because in the early part of the Second World War, when the Finns and the Russians had a difference, the Russians came in and lopped off a part of Finland. If you look at your map, you'll see up there that they got Viborg, and they renamed it Vipuri, it's called now. And this lovely old ancient city has been behind the Iron Curtain since the latter part of the Second World War. Well, we went from there down to the new post-First World War countries of Estonia and Latvia. And in Estonia, we visited Tallinn, T-A-L-L-I-N, I think it is. And Tallinn was a most wonderful old city. As you approached it on a shimmering summer's day in the Baltic, these minarets would come into view, and then gradually, as you got closer, the whole city would become clear, and it was a marvelous approach. Once again, a beautiful old city. I can remember the strawberries were in bloom at that time, and it was wonderful going ashore, and there were very beautiful Estonian young ladies who were only too willing to go for a walk with the cadets, but as usually the case in these situations, one very pretty girl always has an escort of one girl who isn't so very pretty, and if you and your buddy are taking two of them, it's a party for four and not for two. Well, we enjoyed the strawberries with these beautiful girls, who, of course, could speak no English whatsoever, but that didn't seem to matter very much. We then went down to the city, ancient city of Riga in Latvia. And again, Latvia was a recently formed post-First World War country. And Riga was a very ancient city, a seaport, and interesting museums and fortresses. And we spent several days there. From there, we went to Kiel. And here we are now getting to Germany. Now, our visit to Kiel in 1933 was only the second visit of a British ship to Germany. There was only one ship before the Frobisher to come to Germany since the end of hostilities in 1918. And the memories of the First World War were still pretty sharp. And the German Navy had a couple of cruisers, and it was just becoming resuscitated strictly under treaty limits. But the Germans, being what they are, very methodical people with great seaports, they had created these light cruisers, and their navy was on the way up. And this was a friendly visit of the Royal Navy, and the cadets were made very welcome. Incidentally, our cadet life was very restricted. Our leave was always up at 7 o'clock at night. In no circumstances were we ever allowed out after 7 o'clock at night. And you can imagine how we felt coming back at 7:05 and seeing all the officers going off ashore. Not so good. However, we managed to suffer that one out. Well, in Kiel, a couple of interesting observations there. One was that the Germans themselves were making quite a fuss about this visit of a British ship. And everything was laid on, including a fleet of staff cars. Now, these staff cars had chauffeurs who were very smartly dressed. They were not seamen. They were very smartly dressed with brown shirts and riding breeches and polished leggings and boots and Sam Brown belts. And they had a funny little device on their shoulder tabs, which was the swastika. Yeah. And this was actually the very beginning of the first organizations of the Hitler movement.
Yeah.
Although we cadets certainly did not realize that at the time. Well, Kiel was interesting, again, from my own personal point of view, because we were there during their summer sports, sailing and track and field. And the German Navy was having their sports, and they invited the British officers and men to participate in the sporting events, the 100-yard dashes and the shot put and the relay races and so on with the German Navy. Well, I'd been a pretty good sprinter myself in the high school days in RNC, and by golly, I went in this 100 meters of the German Navy, and I won the bloody thing. I became the 100-meter champion of the German Navy in the summer of 1933.
Well, they couldn't beat us in war, and they couldn't beat us in peace either.
And I guess the thrill of that for me, at the time anyway, was that that evening, because I'd achieved such notoriety in this track meet, I was invited by the German admiral to come to a dinner and a dance that he was having that night for the officers of the Frobisher, and for the first and only time in my year as a cadet, I was allowed out over beyond the time of 7 o'clock at night, and I squired the admiral's daughter to dinner and a dance that night.
Fraternizing with the enemy to be.
Yeah.
Was there any talk of World War I when you were there?
Not at that time, no. Not in 1933, but there was shortly after that, but certainly not at that time. One could only admire what the German Navy were doing. They were smart and efficient. They had a sailing ship there called the Gorch Fock, which was their training ship. And incidentally, that ship was taken over by the Allies at the end of the Second World War and taken to the United States, where it became the training ship, the Eagle, for the United States Coast Guard. And it was later replaced by another one, and the Germans now have a second Gorch Fock, a large, full-rigged sailing vessel doing that role.
For the typist, can you spell Gorch Fock?
G-O-R-C-H, and second word, F-O-C-K.
Capital
F-O-C-K, yeah. Like
you.
The Focke Wulf, yeah. Well, at the return of from that, we went through the Kiel Canal and came back to U.K. to Sheerness and Chatham, and that ended the 1 year of training as a cadet in this process, to be followed by 2.5 as a midshipman and another year and a bit as a sub-lieutenant. We then went on summer leave again, and I went many fine places, and by this time I'm getting pretty used to the UK. And we then, having finished that cadet training, the 150-odd, 200 cadets who were on board the Frobisher were all divided up into small groups of five or six, and they were placed in ships of the Royal Navy all over the world to become midshipmen and to do midshipmen's training.
So?
I'll just go on a little bit about midshipmen's training. One could ask where one wanted to go, I suppose, but being a good young officer at that time, I did not ask for any special ship, other than I did ask for a ship that would be in some foreign port, not based on the United Kingdom, because the British Navy at that time had a home fleet, they had a Mediterranean fleet, they had a West Indies fleet, and they had a Far East fleet. And all of these fleets consisted of, for the most part, the main fleets, home and mid, had battleships. They all had cruisers. They all at various times had aircraft carriers. They all had destroyers, and some of them had submarines. So although midshipmen did not go in destroyers and submarines at that moment. So one had some choice. I asked for something abroad, and I was appointed to the battleship Resolution, which was to be part of the Mediterranean fleet. And the ship at the time was in Devonport. And I joined the Resolution in early September 1933 with four other Royal Navy cadets.